I'm chatting here with Anthony Hutton. A bit more of a deep dive, who I think story is worth delving into.
When it got to the realisation of the money's run out, shit, I'm going to have to get a normal job. You know, I was pointed at as, that's the guy from Big Brother Raw. That's the dick from Big Brother Raw. Like, it was a mega extreme taste of fame that I had.
Because you got a bit of a hiding on the way out, didn't you? Were the press nice to you?
One of the best things that I've ever done, opening it. One of the best things I've ever done, closing it. Both.
Yeah.
If you can do something in your life that makes change, it's probably the thing I'm most proud of about working in the hair industry.
Hi, welcome to the Noble Barber Podcast. I'm Anthony Laban, and we'll be talking to various people in the industry who've made it and their journey and how they got here. Talking honest, cutting through the crap, and making sure your story and their story is heard to help your business and hopefully mine. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe button, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi. Welcome to another episode of the Noble Barber Podcast. I'm Anthony Laban, and I'm here tonight at Wolf King's Cross, and I'm chatting here with Anthony Hutton. A bit of a change of format today. We're going for a bit more of a deep dive. From the outset, there's a handful of people I wanted to talk to who I think story is worth delving into. And very nicely, Anthony, thank you, has agreed to be our officially first deep dive. So welcome, mate.
Well, firstly, absolute pleasure to be here. Honoured to be on. I've watched a lot of your stuff. So I'm, over the moon to be on the podcast.
Thank you. Well, I think, like I said, I ran into you at HairCon back in the summer. And we had a kind of 3-minute chat where, you know, I confessed that you'd been on the list and we'd not managed it. So thanks. We caught you in London and appreciate your time.
Yeah, well, it was like kind of a last minute job where I'm working down London. And I thought, oh, like, let's see if there's an opportunity. Yeah. So here we are.
Thank you. But the idea, right, I'm thinking really of when I know, I mean, I guess when your name comes up, the two things that most people think of is Big Brother and never throw in the towel. Both important things in their own right.
Absolutely.
But I think those are the two bits that obviously jump. I'm wondering if we could start a little bit earlier. I'm kind of intrigued at the start of people's career and even, you know, your kind of upbringing and what took you to the Big Brother house and then on from there.
Yeah.
Are you a Darlington lad by birth? Are your folks that way?
No. Originally from a place called Consett, which is just outside of, it's County Durham.
Is that always good old mining stock?
It is. Yeah, my granddad worked there. I always used to lie about where I was from. I used to say, when I used to chat up girls back in the day, I always used to say I was half Sicilian from Consetta. But no.
I think we've all pulled that one.
But yeah, no, from Consett, County Durham. Had a fantastic upbringing. I grew up with my grandma and my mum brought me up.
Oh, okay.
Only child, and I was very much. I'll kind of get into it. I don't know whether you're going to ask this question, but always a really sporty kid. Wasn't very good academic. But always massively thrived in sport and absolutely loved, like most young lads, really wanted to be a footballer.
Right, yeah.
And deludedly thought I was going to be a footballer.
Right. I think that's sadly an awful lot of kids through academy who do that and don't get there.
And in terms of career wise, I remember obviously wasn't a footballer. And had to go to the door and sign on. And I remember feeling like such a loser.
And this is leaving school at 16?
I'd briefly went and done sports studies at college.
Oh, okay.
Purely's on the basis of purely's just to continue doing sport. Wasn't a particular good, I don't think you really got anything from it. And the first job that came up that remotely looked, that seemed appealing was a postman, and became a postman for for a couple of years. That was actually my first ever job.
Wow. Don't worry, it doesn't sit with you for some reason. Did it sit at the time? Did it?
No. So completely not. So, I didn't have any education. I had no trade, and it was the only job I could do. And I remember doing that job for about a year and a half. And you know, when you just like, I just didn't enjoy it at all. Felt as if I had more. And
the 18, 19, I feel you're in a bit of a cul-de-sac already.
Yeah. And always, and I wanted something more. I felt as if I was capable of more. And I literally remember literally racking in me head thinking, how can I change things up? And deludedly or not, the thought that came into my head was, what if I get on TV? What if I get on Big Brother? And that literally became, that started to become a bit of an obsession, really. Like, I was very obsessed.
Had you been watching, so you were kind of, were you series six?
I was, yeah, series six.
Had you followed the previous five?
Yeah. So I was a big fan.
As a training ground, almost.
I was a big fan of the show. And like me sporting background, like I was, like, in reflection, a very, very driven young man. And was very, very obsessive with trying to be a footballer. Like, I was super, super obsessed with trying to be a footballer, really dedicated. And then them kind of traits kind of came into getting on Big Brother, to be honest. So that came into my head, and done my job occupation. I mean, what happened was I literally quit the post office job and landed a job as a 1970s disco dancer.
Now, I don't know why that seems to sit better with you, I think.
So I landed a job in a dance troupe called the Stretch Limos Boogie Express. And
that already existed without you.
They already existed.
Love it.
And I remember I got the job. I had to finish the post office job. I would remember literally running around delivering mail because I had to go and do this audition to get into this dance troupe. And anyway, got the job. Guy rang us up. Stretch Limo was the boss. This is all true story, by the way. And he said, and he was like, right, I like your look. He went, you're going to be called Chico Importante, the face of Colgate 1977, teeth of whiteness, arse of tightness. And that was my job. And I'll always remember this.
I just love that as a job title.
Yeah. And
this is still all around.
This is all around the Northeast.
Yep.
There was Whitley Bay, South Shields, Sunderland, Newcastle, and then went up Scotland Friday, Saturday. It was literally like a kind of full-time job, but it was on the evening. And I always remember this. The next door neighbour asked me grandma. They said, "How come there's always a wig on the line?" She was like, "Oh, he's a disco dancer now." And they were like, "Oh, right, okay." And but all that work was on the evening, and I was always into the hair industry. I was probably always a closet hairdresser or barber,
right?
Because I always remember, I'll never forget going, I think I was around about 17, went to Tony and Guy, Newcastle City Centre, went into this salon and there's music on, everyone was attractive, got me hair shampooed, and I always like, oh my God, like, I love this. But because I was a football lad, I always like kind of like the being a hairdresser was a girl's job, or, you know, you were gay if you got that job. So I kind of was like, well, I can't do that. And then the salon came on Channel 4.
Yeah.
And that was, in reflection, a massive inspiration for me, because I'd seen, you know, these cool straight guys who were hairdressers. Mm. And then I started like thinking, I want to be a hairdresser. I want to get into hair. So I just started hunting for courses, and came across a company called Saks, which were quite, well, yeah, still a big, big company in the hair industry. And yeah, so I was a 70s disco dancer and a trainee hairdresser, which again was quite hard to talk to girls, because I was trying to explain that, saying I'm straight, when you were a 70s disco dancer and a hairdresser. But
you're very driven to be running two jobs.
Yeah, yeah. But doing them two things, that was more me.
Yeah.
Being a postman just wasn't me. And then it really gave us a lot of confidence, where it was like, right. And then when I went to the Big Brother auditions, you know, and, you know, I remember queuing up.
I mean, I don't know how big it is now, but I mean, back then it was huge. I mean, it was one of the biggest watched TV shows. You know, the crowds of people that went for kind of eviction nights were, it was enormous. It was such a huge prime time TV thing at the time. So the auditions was join the queue, and it was a bloody long queue.
Literally set off half three in the morning, early hours of Saturday morning, and drove to Manchester. And I think a lot of people were turning up for fun, whereas I was turning up to get on, and then queued up, told them I'm a 70s disco dancer, and immediately that was kind of like,
oh, that loosened the lock.
Well, they actually stuck it straight on me. They said they told me to dance.
Right.
So I started dancing like John Travolta with no music on in front of a bunch of randoms.
But well rehearsed dance routine.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, yeah, it's what I was doing. But great, great memories.
And from that audition to actually entering the house, what was the time frame of that? Was that quite quick?
No, it was, I'm trying to think.
Because you're not meant to have all your friends knowing you're going in and things, are you?
No, that was, it would have been about, looking back, maybe about 3 months, but it was I auditioned on the Saturday, felt as if that went really well. They invited me back on the Sunday, and they basically said, you'll not hear anything from us if you don't get on. If we do want you, we'll get in touch. Then round about 2.5 weeks before the show started, at this point, I just assumed I wasn't on. But I was thinking, I wonder if I've auditioned with anyone who's got on. And then I remember on it, I'd got a call from a withheld number. Nearly didn't answer it. I thought it was going to be a girl, but I answered in any case, and it was Big Brother. They asked me to go down to London to go and see them, and then within a couple of days they told me I was a housemate, and then I got hidden away in France.
Wow. And was there any prep? Because by then presumably they knew you were going to be tabloid fodder. Were they prepping you for that, or were they just like, you're going to have a great time, you're going to have a great time, you're in the house?
No, there was, in the meantime, there was, so in them 2 days, there was I met with a psychologist.
Oh, okay.
They asked us like a load of questions, but I wouldn't say there was huge prep, but to be perfectly honest, they could have told me I was going to be fighting with lions, and I would have still went.
You've got the gold.
I'm going in. That was, it was too much of a, it, like you said, it was, when I got on, it was very much at the crest of
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Huge. I think a lot of people won't get their head around how. I mean, I think it's running again now, and it's.
It's a minor stream show now.
And
well, it was because it was the only reality TV show going, and there was no social media, so you know people were tuning in, and what that was.
Oh, people were watching through the night.
Yeah,
night cameras.
Yeah.
I mean, it was huge.
Yeah.
And so, and then you were in.
Yeah.
And the world presumably changed quite dramatically at that point.
Yeah. Funny story though, but so my grandma. So obviously you're told you can't tell anyone. And God bless my grandma, she fully always had my back. So they told the press on the Friday dinner time who's going in and names. So all the press had turned up at my grandma's house. But she just, you know, they were going, oh, you know, Anthony's going in. And she didn't flinch. She stuck completely to get to the game plan. So she was like, no, he's went dancing. I've sent him off today. I don't know what you're talking about. And they were like, no, he's going in the Big Brother. So they thought she didn't know, but she totally knew, but she was still sticking to the, listen, no one happening. Knows.
Yeah.
You can't let anything slip.
Brilliant.
So yeah. And then, you know, come back from France after being hidden in France for 2 weeks.
And that's just you. Me
and another chaperone.
Oh, okay.
But that was a scream, to be honest. So the chaperone was 25. Me and him got on like a house on fire. We had road trips to Paris. We were having parties in our house. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, the stories that we've got from the France trip, they were fantastic. But I always remember I had to come back, and I had to wear a mask to keep my identity hidden, and then had to stay in the hotel and had strict instructions of like, you can't leave the room. If anyone knocks, do not come in because it could be press. But I remember on the Thursday night, and it was just mind blown. It was this, you know, this thing I had on a pedestal, this kind of, this dream was actually soon to become a reality. And I remember thinking, I can't believe tomorrow I'm actually going in the Big Brother house. And yeah, Kate got out the car and...
I mean, the crowds when you went in were ridiculous. It was kind of like,
yeah,
take that concerts. Or,
yeah,
you know,
it was carnage.
It was properly insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you love that?
Oh,
that kind of level of popularity on an instant.
I did. Yeah. To be perfect honest, I took to that like a duck to water. Like, you know, loved it. It was this, like I said, it was this dream that had come off. And I'll never forget though, I actually got booed when I walked in, which isn't normal. So normally people get booed when they leave.
Yeah.
Whereas I got severely booed when I went in. So I, in the audition process, I was giving it big cheese about saying that I was going, listen, the entrance night, I'm going to be giving the big one. I says, I'm going to be dancing, high-fiving.
And they played this VT before you.
No, it was, I didn't come across great because I knew I had to say a few bold statements. I was aware of that. But also, I told them I was going to be given the big one, so I felt as if I have to be a man of my word. So I did give it the big one, and I looked like a dick.
Right.
So by the time I'd got to the like end of the crowd, they were basically saying, like, boo, boo. So I remember walking in going, oh, wow. Like,
wow.
I've just been booed at you. This is not a good start
at all. Yeah.
No, but I'll be honest. I did still think in my head, just wait till you get to know me, because that was something that I was confident that I'd always my grandma always taught me a very simple message, and it was, it's nice to be nice, and that's always stuck with me all my life, and that them simple things or, you know, how can, you know, you can't go wrong if you're nice.
Mm, yeah.
So I was still confident that I would, you know, come across all right.
Yeah. And then you were in there for, is it 3 weeks?
Oh, no, 3 months.
Is it 3 months?
Three months.
It's a while. I haven't gone back.
Yeah. No, well, I think it might be that now.
Now, yeah, maybe that's what
but
it is.
But back then it was a very long stint. Mm. So 78 days, which is just under 3 months. And it was very organic in terms of how it was, what you've seen is what it was like. So I remember I'd done This Morning TV a couple of years back, and actually there was a guy who'd been on Love Island. So me and him started talking about our experiences from doing reality TV. His experience was way different from mine. So he talks about Love Island, and he said it was just so heavily produced. He said, we're getting told to stand there, speak to that person. Wow. They're getting haircuts, they're getting all this type of stuff. Whereas my experience from doing Big Brother was literally, I lived in a house, I only spoke to the housemates I was with, and I only ever spoke to a voice called Big Brother, who never, ever, ever changed character. And that's what it was like. And it was...
Because you stayed quite... I mean, from what I remember of it, you stayed, you know, fairly solidly. You were one of the characters that did stay yourself all the way through. But for a kind of hometown boy, presumably hadn't been away from the family for that amount of time before.
Yeah.
Did you have to dig deep during that? Or were you just in your element?
I think the psychologist said our personality traits, I was probably suited to the process. So I've always been extremely composed, very, very composed by nature. I always wanted to win the show. So my mindset was, I have to be here till the end. And I always just thought the best thing I can be, the best chance of me winning is just to be myself. Mm. And because I was so over the moon to be on there.
Yeah.
So every single day, I was buzzing.
It was all a gift.
I was loving it. Yeah. And I couldn't understand people complaining. So many people were twisting and complaining. And I thought, what? How were you? We're on the telly.
Yeah.
Like, we're on Big Brother. What are you whinging for? Like, I don't understand it. And you know, they were all my mindset. Yeah. And with all them balled together, probably were good tools to last in the show.
And you did. You won, didn't you?
Yeah.
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 Won the visualization working in force. I mean, that was...
Well, I remember...
It's an amazing amount of competitiveness for you.
Well, you know what it is? I remember when I read the book, The Secret. And I remember just looking at it going, well, I've been doing this for years. I've been visualizing. Mm. Like, you know, I ended up doing a football program called The Match, where I played in front of the 52,000 at St. James's Park on Sky and got man of the match. Both years. Sorry, that's me. That's me. That's me. That's me pub brag. But again, and people might think I'm mad, but I used to be I was Newcastle United season ticket holder as a young boy. Went to the games with me best mate John, and always just was like, I'm going to play here one day. I know I'm going to play here. And, you know, I didn't become a professional footballer, but I remember stepping out in front of the crowd, and I remember seeing my parents at the game, and I always like I always seen this happen. And again, I don't know whether that's just being utterly deluded, but I always kind of seen it.
Yeah.
And I always did see myself winning Big Brother. Mm. And again, some people will think that's just fluke or deluded, but for me, I've always believed in stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it's worked. Don't rock it.
Well,
and the experience itself, anything that you regret?
Good question. So it had very highs and lows in reflection. So it was like it was a mega extreme taste of fame that I had.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
a young,
it really was.
a young lad in his early 20s from concert. and then catapulted into Big Brother, making colossal amount of money. Mm. Everyone knowing your name, but there was huge lows that came transitioning out of that.
You got a bit of a hiding on the way out, didn't you? Were the press nice to you?
Generally speaking, it certainly didn't bother me too much that side of things.
Because the press really did go for all the Big Brother out one after the other. You were herded into a double page spread, and everything about you was kind of laid out. I'd find that quite tough going.
I didn't pay too much attention to that. I remember there was particularly one female reporter who was, you know, looking back, awful, mm-hmm. awful. But I think there was certainly at the beginning, there was so much awesome things happening, with money and the amount of fun stuff and celebrity type stuff you were doing, that kind of like, and because I was just a young daft lad, I was a bit numb as well. Just my being naive and not really just a daft lad was probably a good shield.
Didn't go too deeply with any of it, just enjoying.
None of that affected me too much. Pretty much what it was when everything died down, like, and then it got to the realization of the money's run out. Shit, I'm gonna have to get a normal job. That was like the ego, the pride.
Because you were on huge amounts of TV shows, every magazine, papers. I mean, it was proper huge celebrity.
Yeah.
That lasted 6 months, a year.
I churned that out for years.
Oh, really?
I managed to do it for a good four years, maybe even five, where I was still getting pantomimes and the odd bit of stuff, where I was still able to not have to get a normal job. But then when it started to fully, literally nothing was coming in, because your identity, you know, I was pointed at as that's the guy from Big Brother, or that's the dick from Big Brother, or my identity was tied to Big Brother. So the realization of having to get a normal job was at the time horrendous. Mm. And it was, you know, it was very, I had to dig deep to come out of that headspace that I was at. But to answer your question, would I change anything? I wouldn't change anything, because for me, life is a journey. Mm. And all of the losses, they're all lessons, aren't they?
Sorry to interrupt, but I want to talk to you about something really important. Our podcast here is more than just about the industry, the barbershop, and the life therein. It's about the community that we built. And in the time we've been doing this podcast, the community has been amazing, and we've loved it. Now we're looking for you to get involved and become an essential part of our future. We're seeking long-term, mutually beneficial opportunities for partnership to come on board and help spread our message, to connect with our community, to help grow it, to keep the message strong, and to keep hearing and discussing these amazing topics that we do with all our guests. If you think your brand is the right brand for us, if you want to get in touch, please email me at thenoblebarberpodcast@gmail.com or DM me on Instagram. Be really good to talk to you. We'd love you to be part of our future. Okay, and now back to the episode. It's a great mindset to be able to kind of go, hey, this is an experience. What's next?
Yeah, but mind you, I'm 43 now, and it's took me a lot of years to have that mindset.
Yeah, no, of course.
You know, if you asked me at the time, oh my God, there's not a chance I was saying that.
And the money, the jobs all disappeared and you were back at home, or had you got yourself sorted out properly before that?
No, so it was like, you know, I'd missed 5 mortgage payments. Luckily enough, I'd lent money off family back in back in the house with mum and grandma, where I'd, you know, where I'd grew up as a young boy.
Wow.
So really, like, had to
when you came down with a pump, had to dig deep
and got back into the hair industry.
But you'd not done anything with that for 5 years. You'd never actually worked as a hairdresser or a barber.
So
you've done the training.
Done the training, worked in a salon for a little bit, and then I was out of touch.
Hmm. So how did you start? What was the way back?
So it was a little bit of luck. So I remember I was in a terrible headspace, and was thinking, should I get back into the hair industry? And there was a guy who I'd worked with at Saks, and he reached out and said he was opening a barbershop and a salon, and he said, you know, I want to get you involved. And that was the branch that I needed, to be honest. And like I said, I wasn't in a good headspace at all. I was hanging around with acquaintances that I shouldn't have been around, and I knew I wanted to get away from them. And this was this salon was in Darlington, so it was literally like I didn't know anyone,
right.
And that was the I knew I needed like a really clean start. I needed fundamentally to change things up in my life, and that's what I done. I moved to Darlington. I had the house share with this lovely couple who I'm still friends with now, and I got that first job. And that first job, I can honestly say, probably turned out to be one of the best moves I ever made, because I was starting from the bottom again, but I knew I was making the right steps. And that first job, I end up meeting my now wife, who have got two lovely boys too, and a girl on the way. And then my life started, the comeback was on, and then my life started building momentum, and then ended up opening a business. And
so you opened up Mr. Hutton's, what was it called?
It was called Mr. Hutton's Barbers and Bar.
And what was the time lapse from kind of everything crashing to opening up the store?
Oh God, my mind blurred on the time scale.
It was several years rather.
Yeah,
than,
yes.
Than...
Yes, several years. I moved to Darlington in 2013, worked in the salon, and then 2015 I opened up business, Mr. Hutton's Barbers and Bar. So
did the kind of celebrity status help with your barbering career when it kicked off? Were people impressed? Were you getting people coming to get their hair cut because they wanted to meet the
Well,
big
I've
brother?
Always said, I've always, there's negatives and positives with everything, isn't there? I've always took the positives, and I can honestly say still it's 20 years since I was on the show. It's still always open doors.
Mm-hmm.
Still always open doors for me. And so to answer your question, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was able to get a lot of local press involved, a lot of, you know, because it was a unique concept where it was a barbershop through the day and a late licensed cocktail bar in the evening. It was obviously, it had a bit of eyes, but obviously the Big Brother background added a little bit extra on that as well.
And it had great success.
Yeah, absolutely. It was... we touched off camera before. In reflection, a terrible businessman, but it was a strong business model.
Hmm.
So I've always been like creative. So, you know, it was.
And you loved it while you were doing it. I mean, you loved it and lived it.
Oh, absolutely.
When you were saying you were doing 15, so you were barber by day, bartender by night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So and you were back grafting.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you'll know yourself when it's your baby. Mm. You know what I mean? It's like you're obsessed with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. And like the stories that I've got from it are absolutely, honestly.
A cocktail bar in Darlington. That's going to get a few stories knocking around.
No, trust me, honestly, I've got some stories. So many funny stories. And for me, the rules are different with bar.
Yeah.
With a bar, the rules are different. Like in terms of like professionalism is important, but it's also you want your staff to have fun because it's a bar.
Was there with the bar? Did the two teams mix? I know you were jumping behind the bar, but did you have other barbers that cut during the day and then did a shift?
No, there was just me. There was just me who'd done that. But it kind of did intertwine. Like on a Friday, the bar would open up when I was still cutting hair. And I always used to love that because every time when I was cutting hair at say 4 or 5 o'clock, and then I would look down and then the bar started filling up. It was always a beautiful feeling because it was always like, I had this vision. I always seen it because I always had so many people saying, this is a stupid idea. It's a ridiculous idea. It doesn't make sense. But for me, I was like, I think it does make sense. Mm. Like all I need is a separate barber room. Like, and the rest can be a bar. I always thought it was a concept that worked. So
it presumably gave you back that element of celebrity, I guess, like to some extent, and that success and feeling successful.
Yeah, so I don't think, to be honest, it probably had a bit more, there was probably a bit more meaning to it because the Big Brother thing was almost like, you know, although I went for auditions and stuff, it felt like a bit of a gift in terms of I didn't really have to work hard for it. Whereas the setting up the business,
you created
that
this.
Was something that I had to work hard for. But it definitely, for me, it did have that feeling of you've had that high, you've had that low, now you've come back.
Yeah.
It definitely did have that feeling. I remember the first night I had to go in the back and I was crying because of the place I'd been in, the headspace I'd been in. This was like, you know, this was like, I was so proud that I'd managed to kind of come back.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I had what I deemed as success. So yeah, it was a great feeling that I'll never forget that moment.
Yeah, no, well done, amazing. And then it's now gone. How long did you have it for?
Had it for 10 years. I always say...
And a good 10 years? You enjoyed it all the way through?
The latter stages probably didn't, yeah. I always say it was one of the best things that I've ever done opening it, one of the best things I've ever done closing it, both.
Yeah.
And you know, again, we touched on this off camera. It was hard closing. I probably should have closed it maybe two years before I closed it, but that, you know, element of ego. But I don't think ego in a bad sense, but it was just like, it was my baby and my identity.
And it's very hard to accept that it's failed and it's gone. I mean, I had my first business for, 20 years.
Yeah.
And the year of before I closed, it was a brutal, brutal year in my life.
Yeah.
In the 2 days before it actually locked it up and handed the keys back and walked away from it, really dark.
Yeah.
But genuinely within 2 days of it being closed, I'm like, why on earth didn't I do that before?
Yeah.
It had just done its time. It had done and probably more than its time.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a weight off.
Yeah.
Just a weight off your shoulders. And it's never as bad as you think, is it? Pretty much more situations that you build up in your head, it's never as bad.
It feels horrendous before.
Oh, absolutely.
But I've spoken to so many people that have closed down businesses and there is of, you know, it's a great time afterwards. You know, yeah. I've now set up other, I love what I do now.
Yeah.
But I'd never have believed you at the time.
Yeah. Like what, you know, what I'm doing now, I wouldn't be doing now.
But if, that started while you had Mr. Hutton's?
Or that, no.
Was that was so?
No.
Barbershop had gone.
No, so.
And you were.
So that this whole project that I've set up, it, like, you know, when it has a very strong feeling of faith for me. It really has a strong feeling of purpose and stuff. But I remember when I'd just come out of the business, or I knew I was going to, and I remember I'd just become a dad as well.
Wow.
And my grandma had passed as well. So I was in it.
This is all happening in the same year.
This is all happened around about the same time, yeah. And there was a lot, when you become a dad, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I've really wanted to be successful. And I always remember thinking, like, what the hell? You know, I remember walking to work, and my head was just battered because I was thinking, well, what do I do? Like, what am I going to do? Obviously, I was going to stay in the hair industry, but I was kind of like going, I don't know whether being a barber is going to produce the type of living that I want to live. I don't think I'm going to maybe make the money that I want to make. And so I was starting to like, I was thinking, right, well, if I work offshore, but I hate, and then I'm a barber as well. I was just racking my brains. But then, like I said, my grandma passed, and there's chapters that have led me to setting up the project. And the last chapter comes from my grandma. So the first chapter that's led me to set up the Never Throw on the Towel project, that comes from, you know, having my own struggles from reality TV, like, which I've touched on. Then obviously got into the hair industry, working as a barber. And then because I was fascinated with the conversations that I would have in the chair, the connection that you would build. And, you know, there was multiple times where blokes were opening up to me in the chair. And I had a huge urge of wanting to help, because I felt as if I could. And I felt, because I had a real emphasis of like, oh, look, I've been in this place before, mate, honestly. And I wanted to give advice because, like I said, I felt as if I could help. So there was always that kind of urge from the mental health perspective that was always kind of like niggling away at me. Then my grandma passed, and that was the hardest period of my life that I've ever had to go through, because she was such a huge part of my life. My grandma was like my mum, and I literally held my grandma's hand on her very last breath. And I remember when it was time to organise the funeral, and then there was conversations that came about who's going to do grandma's eulogy, who's going to tell her story at the end. And at the time, I didn't really know what a eulogy was, and I was like, "All right." And so I said to the family, "I said let me do it. Never shied away from anything, and I'm not shying away from this. I don't want the priest or anyone else doing it. I want to do it." And I literally took this eulogy like so serious, and I locked myself away for a couple of days, and I started writing this amazing story about this amazing woman who was huge in my life. When I came to the end of the eulogy, I started getting upset because I had to start talking about my grandma's cancer and her passing. And but then the fighting spirit came over me, and I told myself her story isn't going to end on a negative. Her story's going to end on a positive. And right at the end of the eulogy, I used the words, she never threw in the towel. And she done everything she possibly could to keep on living. And I started talking about her mindset and her attitude to everyone who attended the funeral. Straight after the funeral, I walked outside the church and there was a man waiting for me who had attended the funeral, and he was in floods of tears. He was so emotional. And he grabbed my hand, shook my hand, and he said, thank you so much for that eulogy. He said, your grandma would be so proud. And anyway, the same night I was at my grandma's house, you know, in the sitting room, in the living room where I grew up, feeling all emotional. And then my phone pinged, and it was a message from the same man who was waiting for me outside the church. And he sent me this huge, long message sharing with me how much he's struggling with his headspace, to the point of he's had to go and see professional help. And right at the end of the message, he says, I just need to let you know, I'm clinging on to the words, never throw in the towel, which you spoke about your grandma. And that gave me goosebumps. Mm. And I just couldn't stop looking at this message. And it just lit a fire in that. I just thought, I have to start talking about this topic. This is a calling for me. And I just literally just started, there was just this fire started burning in me. And it highlighted to me the power of a story.
Yeah.
And I actively just started trying to speak on this topic. And when I first got my first opportunity at speaking at an event, there was a woman called Holly. She called me up and she says, right, she says, I'm going to book you as a speaker at this event. And she said, what's your talk called? And it was like, the talk's called Never Throw in the Towel. And I couldn't believe the impact. I was petrified about doing this talk.
Where was the first?
It was in Newcastle. Talk? Yeah. At this a great woman called Holly Matthews. She's got this project called the Happy Me Project. And this was so timely. So I'd done the talk and I started getting multiple messages. People with a similar experience, or they knew someone who died from suicide. And November approached. So I was like, I'm going to do the Never Throw in the Towel project. And that consisted of two things. First thing was free haircuts. So I'd done a post on social media saying, Barbershare is one of the best places to talk for a man. I'm doing free haircuts throughout November. If anyone wants to have a chat, come and see me. And then the second thing was a free meetup in nature for men. And I just tailored the day around everything that I am into. So we've done a walk and talk. We've done some boxing. We've done some breath work. And then we all had a cold water dip at the end. And there were 7 men attended. And it was just meant to be like a one-off. But all 7 men who were in the WhatsApp group, they reached out afterwards and said, look, the day was absolutely amazing. There was a couple of blokes who really needed it, who opened up and talked. So they said, will you do another one? Done a second one, 31 men attended. Third one had 72 men attend. And it just blew up. And then I had the idea of like...
And this is reaching out through kind of social media?
Yeah,
and...
just on social media, yeah. This was just on social media. And then I'd seen the power of a story. And then I was like, what if I'd do the story and then have a safe space to follow up from the story with a pop-up barbershop. So, and I was like, is that it? I think that's a good idea. So there was a bloke whose hair I was cutting, a guy called Phil. He owns a factory with like 80 blokes. And I said, I just pitched the idea to him. I said, like, would you mind if I came in and done a talk to all your staff? And then I'll do a pop-up barbershop. Done that. And there was three men in the chair who opened up about attempting to take their own life. And there was just other stuff, fascinating stories of people who'd, and I was like, wow, this is needed. Mm. And went on LinkedIn, and then the rest, you know, it's really snowballed into something that's really, really grown.
And this is pretty much your full-time
occupation
now,
is
the talks and...
Yeah. Yeah, I've went full-time with that now. That is my main earner now, and I still cut hair a couple of days a week, but that's starting to... That
is that just... You got a studio or something that you...
Yeah, I literally just rent a chair and do a couple of days a week, but... I'm doing that like out of habit and out of loyalty to customers. Like I don't need to do that anymore. Sure. But yeah, this project that I'm doing, I absolutely love it.
And the conversations after, so you do a talk, the guys that are coming to have a haircut are really just wanting to talk more.
Well, it's so for me working in the field now, it's like, I'm working at a construction company these couple of days. Men, I feel as if they almost have to have mental health in disguise. Mm. Because if I'd done the talk and said, come and see me for a mental health chat afterwards, you're probably not going to come and see me. Come and see me for a free haircut. Is that in? With, yeah. Without any pressure, without any stigma, it's just coming for a haircut. But sometimes the haircut turns into asking for help, and that's...
And with the help, are you then encouraging them over to seek more professional, or have you got a team that are working to back them up
so
with this, or how does it happen?
Yeah, so I'll literally just basically inform HR, and then, for example... If it's, say, construction, there's an amazing charity called the Lighthouse Charity where they've got professionals. So I just simply pass them over to professionals if they need it. Mm. That's what I do, yeah.
Wow. Got to be an amazing kind of feel-good.
Oh, I mean, I've definitely discovered it. If you can do something in your life that... makes change for good and you can make some impact, it's one of the best things you can ever do in your life. Mm-hmm. Because it's actually equally as rewarding. Like it's so rewarding, and like I said, it's probably the thing I'm most proud of about working in the hair industry, where I've actually been able to use the barber chair as a tool to literally try and change culture in workplaces. Because for me, I mean, is there a better place for a man to talk?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I think for years and years, I mean, I started off as a, you know, I'm a hairdresser,
yeah,
and also a barber. And so I think that kind of therapy side, women have been historically so much better at confiding in their hairdresser, if you like. Whereas guys... I found now do exactly the same. It's a real safe, open space. And you suddenly realize it is okay to struggle.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly found when I closed my business, where, you know, I've been very fortunate. I have a fairly kind of emotionally quite steady, but I struggled.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky that, you know, I was able to talk, and I talked to my missus and saw the daylight and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I speak to so many guys who really do are in dark places a lot.
Yeah.
And you do know the responsibility that you're probably the only person they're telling. They'll walk out and go and see a mate for a pint, and they'll be chatting and laughing, and that friend will know nothing. You know, that's the scary bit.
Well, I think is like as hairdressers working in the hair industry, by trade probably, we are good communicators, aren't we? We probably all have a bit of a feminine touch to us. I certainly do. But for example, construction. So construction's the worst profession in the UK for suicide.
And it's
heavily down to
because it's the
culture.
Kind of blokiest culture you could have come across.
The most gadgiest bloke. So initially you'd be like, wow, like no way. But actually when you strip it down, and it's heavily around these blokes, you know, find it hard to communicate and be vulnerable. And they will naturally think it's a weakness, but actually, in turn, actually, being vulnerable and open and talking is actually a strength.
Yeah,
it's not weak. It's a strength.
Well, I was amazed when we closed, the amount of people that came forward to help when I actually asked for help.
Yeah,
the amount of people who I wasn't expecting.
Yeah,
and the people, if I'm honest, the people that I thought would leap to my aid. Disappeared.
Right.
And I think, hand on heart, honestly, that was probably the first time I've ever stopped and had to be that vulnerable and open up and ask for help.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I was, you know, down and not sure what's doing next.
Yeah.
And it was revelation for me to find people wanting to support me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think
good people out there.
Certainly in a very blokey environment. I think it'd be really, it would have been very easy for me to bottle that, push that down, shove another pint down my neck and pretended everything was fine.
I mean, but look at us by trait, we take the piss out of each other.
Yeah.
So we've immediately got like a shield up constantly.
Yeah. You got your ball. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's embedded. It's embedded in us. And this is why I think it's so important to tailor mental health for men, because you know, but a bunch of posts, like companies constantly tell people or men to talk, open up, but the fact is they probably won't.
No.
And this is why I think it's like, this is why what I do actually does work, because it just gives them it's just a slight nudge, and it's a safe space. Whereas if they didn't have that, they probably wouldn't come up and talk. And this is why I think it's obviously my initiative and it's what I do, but I'm so passionate about it just because it works and it can help.
And future, where do you see this going? Where do you see?
That's a great question. I'm just wanna, well, what one of the things I want to do, I want to get the, so I hold monthly free meetups for men every single month, but it's just me who does it. I'm setting up a KIC, like a CIC, which is like it's like a charity with less red tape. It's a bit smaller, but with that you get funding and stuff. So I would like to spread that out where I get different men who are ambassadors taking these monthly free meetups for men. So that's something that I would love to do. I'm loving what I do. And again, just also, but it's, you know, it's great to be ambitious, but also I'm a dad to two little boys and I've got another little girl on the way. So it's just having that balance as well. I'm enjoying the ride. I would like to do I'm a speaker now. God knows how I managed to do that. So I do a lot of speaking work. I think I would like to stand on that red dot and do a TEDx talk.
Yeah.
I've got my eye on that.
Yeah.
But
well, I think with your track record, I'll settle in to look forward to that one.
Well, I'm just not I'm not going to stop till I do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I don't mean to be cocky when I say that. I just believe if you really, really want to do something, you can do it.
Mm.
And then I've got another couple of, there's a subscription model that that I'm about to do. I've got an initiative of putting journals into schools. And there's another couple of stuff I've got going on with the project. So some real exciting stuff. And yeah, like I said, I, you know, absolutely love it. And it's fantastic because I get to prime me PowerPoint is pretty much at the heart of it. It's my grandma. So I get to talk. My grandma's still here. Funny story about my grandma, you know, this is, I'll just like, don't know how much long we've got, but my grandma actually helped me win Big Brother. Because so back in 2005, to win the show, it was down to public vote.
Right, okay.
And inside a week, my grandma racked up a £4,000 phone bill.
Jesus.
And you know,
good girl.
Yeah, and you know the funny thing was, and you can it's obviously probably you can watch it somewhere. So when I won, the first thing that I screamed out live on Channel 4 was Granny Hutton, I did it. And she replied in our sitting room saying, thank God you can pay the phone bill. and I did.
I love it.
So yeah, I talk about my grandma for a living, which is beautiful.
No, that's amazing. Enjoying being a dad?
Oh, the best. The best. I had, for me, it was, you know, we could get deep, but I've never spoke to my dad ever, and I take positives from that because when I became when I met my wife and stuff and we were having a child and stuff, she got pregnant and we didn't find out what we were having, and I just so much wanted a boy. Like, and I felt guilty how much I wanted a boy. But I think it was really deep rooted into the fact that I really wanted to experience that father son relationship. And when I seen a big set of balls come out, that was probably just the best thing I've ever seen. And the massive, aren't they?
The rest of the body does eventually grow into it.
Yeah. No one told me about the big ball situation. I was like, we've just had King Kong here.
Yeah.
For me being a dad is the best gift you can ever taste in life for me. So yeah, absolutely love it.
Yeah, you think this, that your approach, so your mindset, your boys will grow up with a very open and clear understanding of their emotions, and it's okay.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would, yeah, absolutely. I mean, God, I'd just, you know, me we call it the Italian kiss. Me and my eldest son, every single day we give a kiss on either cheek. They get brought up like Italians in terms of the kissing situation on the cheeks. Love. But yeah, just, you can't go wrong if you show love, kindness, openness. If you have them fundamentals, I think you're going to hopefully have good people.
I have probably much a similar relationship with my father from the off, and wasn't keen to be a dad. But one of the best things I've ever done. It's been absolutely amazing. I've got two grown-up lads now, and I was just saying to Luke, who's got a seven-year-old, we still hug each other hello, and you know, everyone kisses each other goodbye, and I think that's a great place to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, mate. I'm so pleased we had that conversation. Yeah. I've no idea how long that's been going, but I've really enjoyed it.
Well, I can talk a lot, so apologies my end.
Really appreciate your time, and I'm really pleased we finally did it.
Yeah.
Guys, I hope you like that deep dive. I hope it's impacted you as much as it has me. And we've been The Noble Barber. Thank you very much. Good night.
Welcome to The Noble Barber Podcast. We're always looking for interesting people and interesting stories. If you know someone or you are someone with a great story that you want to share, get in touch and come join me on the sofa. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next time.